Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host David Lohr. I should get this right some one of these days.
It's all right. Most people don't. The OE throws everyone off. Like, it should be an O with an umlaut, and somewhere in Ellis Island they went, you keep the umlaut, but no, this line gets the OE.
You know, it's all part of the rich tapestry that is the Sophomore Lit diaspora at this point. We have so many co-hosts, and they come and go. And you have come, and you want to do William Carlos Williams poetry.
It's because I'm a minimalist, clearly. No, I grew up with a father who loved William Carlos Williams. And that was someone who, I should say, is my stepfather. So I had, you know, 12 years of, you know, getting to know the world and getting to know famous poets' names because my mother taught English. And then I had never heard of him. And then they marry, we move to New York, and here's this whole library of books of this poet that I've never heard of. Who is this guy? This isn't T.S. Eliot. This isn't, you know, Wordsworth or Dryden or any of these guys. And so I started kind of going through. And, you know, and of course you have that early reaction of, this doesn't rhyme. What's going on? Right? I had never experienced poetry like that either. And the few times my mother pushed it at me, I would just be like, this isn't poetry. And it must have hit me at just the right age then, because suddenly it was like, this is beautiful stuff. One of the nice things where I went through all my adolescence and high school and a little past high school, we lived outside Princeton, New Jersey. And so we would go into the university all the time. And I would just, that's just where I hung out. And thanks to a book signing and several other events, I became friends with several of the poetry professors there. And I would sort of pump their brains. It's like, I want to know more about this. I know I'm not in your class, and I know I'm, you know, not a student at the university, but I just, you know, this is really fascinating. And so they were very indulgent. And it was interesting to see how different poets approached their writing, right? I never even really considered that. It's like, clearly Williams saw the world this way, wrote about it. Wallace Stevens, you know, all these guys, they this is how they were processing the world. And it was fascinating then to talk with these different, you know, legitimate poets. I mean, one of my friends there was Paul Muldoon, who ran the department for a while. I think he still does. I don't know. He was the poetry editor of The New Yorker for 10 years just recently. You know, pretty solid guy in the world of poetry right now. And to talk with him and find out how he approach to the writing of these things, and that it's not just, you know, it doesn't just all come to you in a flood. It's not, you know, it's not even that you're lying under a tree and idly thinking and dreaming and, you know, here comes your poem, that it is work. So seeing how he approached writing the poetry as yes, processing your world, but actually crafting and working and fine tuning. And realizing that a lot of these poets, this was not their day job, right? You can't really have a day job as a poet. And, you know, William Carlos Williams was a physician. That was his day-to-day job. And that inspired a lot of his work, too.
Well, that's a very insider baseball view of this. Given the fact that a lot of my listeners out there tend to object whenever I do one of these poetry episodes, I want to set this for everyone. William Carlos Williams is the "I ate the plums" guy. So that we all know who we're talking about here. I remember the first time I read William Carlos Williams. I read the Red Wheelbarrow, which is probably Up till the invention of the internet or of the web, yeah. I would say that
of the
I
memes.
Would say that was probably his most famous poem. I think that now it's kind of in a dead heat with This Is Just to Say, but I remember reading it in my it was my sophomore lit. Literature textbook, and it was given there with almost no explanation, and I read it and I thought, what the heck is this? And it struck me as odd and unmusical, and the only reason it stuck in my head was it struck me as an odd piece, and my teacher did not really see fit to instill upon us any enthusiasm for Williams. I don't think she had any enthusiasm for Williams. And it wasn't actually until the next year when I was in my art class and my my high school art teacher taught us all basic art history, which is probably why I am now a museum professional. I remember seeing the picture of Charles DeMuth's. I saw the figure 5 in gold, learning the story behind that, which we will get to also in this in this discussion. And that's what brought me back to Williams. Later on in college, I developed a taste for haiku, and of course, Williams and the Imagists derived a lot of their ideas from reading haiku. Whether or not they got it right is debatable, but that's certainly where they were coming from. Williams is, of course, known for these tiny little poems, these micro poems that he wrote. He wrote longer poems, too, if you're wondering out there.
Oh, boy,
but,
yes.
But he's best known for his tiny little poems, and they get anthologized an awful lot.
Right. Well, and, you know, if your first exposure to it is The Red Wheelbarrow, you can look at that and be like, okay, and keep going. If that had been the only thing I knew of him, I'd have just been... Yeah, whatever, man. But it was only because we had this, you know, like 3 bookshelves full of nothing but Williams and books about Williams and, you know, that I was able to say, OK, there is more to this guy than this like 2-sentence, 8-line thing. Right. And I think part of why This Is Just to Say is really taken off as a meme is that it's so much easier to parody. Right. It fits so easily into, you know, you can put anything into that because it wasn't even meant to be a poem. But we'll get to that. The Red Wheelbarrow, we'll also get to parody later. But I did do a parody of the Red Wheelbarrow called The Unstable Wheelbarrow. So much upends deep on the unstable wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside. Right. And, you know, but it's really hard to spoof that poem.
So Williams is part of that generation of poets that were brought up in the world by Ezra Pound, who is a poet who today is best remembered for all the poets he discovered. The trouble with Ezra Pound, of course, is he went on to become a great supporter of Mussolini. He moved to Italy and became a propagandist for Mussolini and was committed after the war to an insane asylum. He also was terribly anti-Semitic. It's not a stretch to say that his fortunes have fallen in the times since the early 20th century. So if you go back and you read collections from the 60s and 70s where people were putting together all the poets of this generation, like Williams or like Randall Jarrell or something like that, people still would mention Ezra Pound and would, and there was kind of a defensiveness about that. I think a lot of poets still felt very fond of Pound, even though the rest of the world had kind of thrown him away. Right. But Pound is credited with encouraging Williams to be a poet and to publish. Williams had an incredible group of friends. You know, he knew internationally people like Man Ray. He knew Arenberg, Wallace Stevens. He knew Marcel Duchamp. And he knew a lot of artists because his mom was a painter, and he wanted, there was a part of him that wanted to always be a painter, and he wrote a lot of art history. And as we will see, some of his poems are about paintings. Some of his poems inspired paintings. So we'll get all into that. Is there anything you want to add to the background of Williams? He's an amazing character.
Well, and he's kind of a bridge between Pound and HD and that whole group in the early 20th century. But then he became a mentor to Allen Ginsberg, who then went on to be, you know, Howl and other poems and all that.
There's also a wonderful photograph that gets reprinted of him as a young writer where he looks an awful lot like Buster Bluth.
I can see that.
The other thing that's interesting, though, about Williams with relationship to other poets is he was a great critic of T.S. Eliot's. He was not happy with T.S. Eliot's steering the direction that modern poetry took. And he, in fact, after reading The Wasteland, that he said it put poetry back 20 years. And it's always, as you were saying before about different poets believing different things, it's always fun to read about modernists, artists and writers, because everybody believed fervently in what they were doing, and they believed fervently that they had discovered the correct manifesto for what they were trying to do and what art should be. They really kind of believed that art was progressing and it was just about to reach perfection there somewhere in the 20th century. And it all took was the right set of rules.
I mean, I joked about being a minimalist. I am so not a minimalist, but I do enjoy writing in that style. And when I think about writing in that style, I think about this line of his. It's sort of his ethos. It's repeated in his epic poem Patterson, sort of as a mantra almost. No ideas, but in things, which is kind of, you know, his work is very straightforward much of the time, where it's just describing moments and describing objects and things and people. And it's very much about the thing itself and not some highfalutin theory or, you know, flights of fancy. There's not a lot of flight of fancy in Williams.
That quote does get used an awful lot, and it's a great quote. He didn't really explain it much in his life, but because he was associated with this group called the Imagists of poets, you know, we take a lot of cues from what they said, and they were drawing upon what they would call, and I forgive me for using the word, it's their word, Oriental sources. They specifically Japanese, mostly, but also Chinese writing. They were in love with this idea of straight language, particularly when held up against, say, the example of someone like Longfellow, or the example of someone like Alfred Lord Tennyson, who kind of ruled the roost poetically in the late 19th century, and they wanted to reject that utterly, that idea of sentimentality, of highly ornate language, of abstract language, of metaphors that were just kind of piled upon each other, you know, rather than actually just describing simple objects.
Right. Yeah, and you know, to be accessible. right? He was all about colloquial English, not not allusions and, you know.
Right. And about the experience, about describing the phenomenology of experience. And let's go to the first poem we're going to talk about here from 1921, The Great Figure.
Among the rain and lights, I saw the figure five in gold on a red fire truck moving tense, unheeded to gong clangs, siren howls, and wheels rumbling through the dark city.
It's an attempt to react to an actual event in the poet's life and to describe it as much as possible through unfiltered language. And what's interesting to me about this is actually was the original intent behind Impressionist painting, too. Today, people think of Impressionism as a kind of a style. They think about all the little blotches of paint and the charm of late 19th century bourgeois Paris. And there's a kind of a nostalgia people feel for a bygone era. But what people don't realize is that the Impressionists were trying to get out in the street and paint what they saw. And they were painting working class subjects or subjects that had no particular meaning at all.
This is one of my favorite poems of his, partly because I didn't know it before the painting, right? I didn't know there was any connection. I fell in love with the painting. And when you come up to this, it's Charles de Muth's The Figure Five in Gold. And, you know, there's, you know, at one point it says Bill, and another point it says, I think it has a WCW, and it's, you know, he's like hidden these things in this image because it's all a reference to the poem. You know, the title of the painting comes from the poem. And when I found that out, I went back and it had been long enough that I had forgotten the poem. But as soon as I read it, all I could see was that painting and feel it. I could feel it in motion in my mind's eye. And they've both captured that moment so nicely. I mean, you individually, they're really nice. But when you put them together, it's so vivid. And obviously, de Muth never saw the moment that Williams is describing. He's just painting from those words. And yet, that painting is full of life. It's my favorite de Muth painting.
Yeah, I really recommend anyone who's not familiar with it to quickly look up Charles de Muth. This will be the first thing that comes up. De Muth was part of an American school called the Precisionists. The Precisionists emphasized observations based upon technology, upon the clean lines of modern urban life. They were a little bit analogous to the Italian movement called Futurism, because both of them had an interest in motion. And certainly, I saw the figure five in gold. De Muth's painting is an attempt to capture motion, but through a very, very precise means, highly draftsman-like.
There are clean lines to it. It reminds me of Frank Lloyd Wright sometimes. I mean, I used to draw things even before I had seen the painting. I used to draw things like that, just the shapes in concatenation and the colors. And, you know, there it's a very Art Deco painting almost.
In this case, the painting does Williams a great service. Quite often when you try to translate one thing to another thing, it doesn't always work. Perhaps it's because it's such a short poem to begin with, and because paintings by their nature, you see the whole in a moment. That right. Time works the same way in both the poem and the painting, and that's a hard thing to pull off.
And there's a speed and a motion to the painting. Because he doesn't have to worry about describing the sound or the rain or anything else. He's describing this one element and leaves the rest for Williams. Williams is all about the motion itself and the sound and the mood. And it's about that moment frozen in time. And the painting is that frozen moment.
This is a pretty good entry point for Williams. If you like this poem, you're probably going to like other poems. Let's turn now to the poem that does stand as the entryway for most people, which is The Red Wheelbarrow from 1923.
So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow, glazed with rain water, beside the white chickens.
In the years since reading this the first time, I have grown to love this poem, but it wasn't a love at first sight for me. It's a kind of an impenetrable poem, you know, if you really take it to be simply what it's saying, there's not even an action that it's describing. It's more
right.
of...
It's a still life in words.
It invites speculation. The fact that it's not... He doesn't begin by just saying the red wheelbarrow. He says so much depends on.
Right. Why? What depends on it?
It is actually going against sort of the imagist idea of describing the thing itself. There's a narrative here that that Williams may have in mind. We aren't privy to that narrative unless we go extratextually, which you can. You can actually find discussions of Williams saying whose wheelbarrow he's describing.
I mean, for the general incomparable listener, this is the poetry world's equivalent of a headcanon.
Exactly. No, definitely. You will decide for yourself why so much depends on the red wheelbarrow. But this is part of what links this so much to haiku in a way that I think... You know, my main problem with haiku is the way it gets taught in schools is always this dumb emphasis upon syllables, which isn't really the way that is expressed in Japanese. It's not actually syllables. It's sound units, which are a different thing. So then kids are told, here, go write a haiku. And all they do is they dutifully count out their syllables and they come up with some stupid observation about a bird in a tree. But haiku are all about they're all about implication. They're all about the key words in the poem that suggest something else. There's always got to be a moment in them that describes the season. There always has to be something that ties what you're viewing to memory or to an event in history. And that's what we don't get in the West.
Right. It's not just 17 beats. The beauty of this to me is that a lot of people will hold this up as an imagist poem. And even when it came out, Williams was like, no, I reject the imagist movement. This is not, you know, and because it does have that tension at the beginning, it has that so much depends. We want to know. And yeah, we may have our own ideas. And then, yes, it feels like an imagist moment, right? Because it is just a description of it. We know that at some point it has rained. It is not raining anymore. And it must be somewhere where there are chickens. I remember when we did this in school. So I'm listening to the teacher, and the teacher, again, clearly has no enthusiasm for it. And the class, as a result, has no enthusiasm for it. And it's like, why do you think Williams wrote the poem this way? And nobody is raising their hand. And finally, I just raised my hand and I said, each stanza looks like a wheelbarrow. And the teacher looked at me like, All right. Fair enough. You know, because is it wrong?
Not really.
Is that why he wrote it that way?
I don't know.
But there is, I mean, it looks attractive on the page. I know that's silly.
No, that isn't a silly point to make, because if you've just heard the reading on this podcast, it might sound like conversational English. But when you read it on the page, it's very carefully shaped for such a short poem.
Obviously, the reading is artfully read. But if you just read it the way it looks, it's so much depends upon a red wheel barrow glazed with rain water beside the white chickens. Even read schematically, it has a certain rhythm to it. It has a certain pause and feel and rise and fall. It's how does that work? How did he do that? I still don't know.
But the latter half of the 20th century, that's when you start to see the rise of concrete poetry. They're drawing on futurist typography. They're drawing upon other developments in graphic design. And poets are starting to shape stanzas on page. As a kid, I found this very tedious. I thought that that was a very dumb thing, because it would be something like, the words all looked like a fish or something like that. And that it always seemed like a very uninteresting thing to me. But when you actually look at some of the more elaborate examples of concrete poetry that came out in the 50s and 60s, they're amazing.
Some of the shaped poems, yeah, even looking at Ginsberg on a page. I'm not a huge fan of Allen Ginsberg, but I respect him, and I'm fascinated by some of his work. And then one of his last poems, it's called Gone, Long Gone, which I think fully like two-thirds of the poem is just the phrase, gone, long gone, long gone away, gone, long gone, long gone away, drove me nuts. It was in the New York Times Book Review, and I was just like, make it stop. But even that poem, you kind of look at it and you see a shape to the words. You know, if you take your glasses off and you can't read them, there's still something to look at, which is really
right.
Cool.
And there's a really interesting tension here, because the imagists saw themselves aligned with the tradition of lyric poetry. You know, if you go back to classical times, poetry was divided between the epic and the lyric. And the epic were things like Homer, where you told a story very long. It took a very long time to recite the whole thing. And probably you weren't going to get done with it in one day's reciting. You would do it for over a course of time. Lyric poetry, as the name implies, was to be sung with a lyre. And it was always from the point of view of someone. There's a persona who is telling their point of view that is quite often a complaint about love or a observation about a time in their life. And so the importance of lyric poetry is it's spoken. It's supposed to be spoken. It's supposed to be heard. And there are poets who really emphasize this above all else. And for a good period of Carlos's life, he was one of those poets who emphasized that above all else. But this is a poem that if you look at it on the page, you're getting a different experience than if you're hearing it. And there's a tension, I think, here between those two modes of experiencing poetry.
Right. I mean, at heart, it's just a red wheelbarrow. Yeah, it's deceptively simple.
Let's move on to now the internet's favorite, William Carlos Williams. This is just to say from 1934.
This is just to say, I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox, and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet, and so cold.
The thing about this poem, the first time I read it, again, it's one of those, you know, what are you talking about? And then you find out this wasn't even meant to be a poem. This was literally a note that Williams left on his refrigerator door for his wife, because he did actually eat these plums and she was probably saving them for breakfast and they were so sweet and cold and he felt sorry for it. And that is literally it. And she wrote him back, and she did actually write a poem in response that basically was, you know, Bill, this is a poem.
I remember when I was in a graduate course, my teacher liked to make the claim that Williams wrote the poems he wrote so short because he wrote so many of them in his office waiting for the next patient to come, and that he was using the back of his prescription pad. That sounds a little bit like urban legend to me. But on the other hand, when I hear this, the origins of this poem, you have to wonder whether there's a grain of truth to that.
right?
You know, and then it makes you wonder about how much of the poetry is purposeful and how much of it is an accident of history. That's part of, I guess, the magic of this. Why is this poem so beloved for memes?
Because you can put anything into it, right? There's a Twitter feed called "This Is Just to Say Bot," which retweets anyone who does a spoof of it. I did one just the other day, the other week, in response to a tweet from a very orange person in a great place of power, who was insulting the leader of another country. And so I just tweeted out, "To my housemates," then in all caps, "Never ever eat the plums which I was saving in the icebox for breakfast, or you will suffer the consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. I bet they were so sweet and so cold, and don't you dare touch my wheelbarrow." And I just thought, you know, I mean, literally, when I read the initial tweet, this is like 50 seconds later I'm typing this. And I thought, you know, whatever. And I've never had a tweet blow up like that. It's had like 25,000 likes. It was crazy. Partly from the meme and people responding going, "Oh, it's the meme. It's great. It's two memes together. It's a Trump tweet and it's This Is Just to Say." And partly from, well, Lin-Manuel Miranda liked it. So a lot of people go, "Oh, Lin-Manuel, yay." The power of Hamilton. And but there were a lot of people who were catching it from the "This Is Just to Say" bot. And, you know, if you mentioned plums and icebox and, you know, and there were people responding to this who went, "What is an icebox? What are you talking about? I've never heard anyone say icebox." And I'm like, "You don't know what I'm spoofing, do you? Oh, well." But yeah, if you just find that Twitter feed, you will find hundreds, if not thousands, probably thousands by now, of smart, not so smart, simple, clever, deep, not deep. I mean, it runs the gamut. It's so easy to plug things into this.
Wasn't there a time about a year or so ago where people kept mixing this with the lyrics of songs from the 80s and 90s?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I mean, that was yeah, a vogue, too, for a while.
Let me see. I've got a couple here. So, for instance, "A little bit of cold plums in my life, a little bit of icebox by my side, a little bit of breakfast is what you need, a little bit of forgiveness, what I seek," right? "Hey now, you're an icebox, get your plums on, so sweet. Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy, but the plums in the icebox, I ate them, maybe." "Blackbird singing in the dead of night, take these breakfast plums and learn to eat. All your life, you were only waiting for a meal this cold and sweet." It's amazing how you can remix this one poem. "I have closed the tabs that were in the browser and which you were probably saving to read. Forgive me, they hogged memory and were so old." Right? I mean, you can plug anything into this.
What I wonder when I read all these is I wonder what Williams would have thought of this. I don't know much about him, but I do know that he himself wrote poems in response to things. In fact, our yes, final poem, let's listen to this final poem, which is in response to a painting by Peter Bruegel the Elder, and it's called Landscape with the Fall of Icarus, from 1960.
"According to Bruegel, when Icarus fell, it was spring. A farmer was plowing his field. The whole pageantry of the year was awake, tingling near the edge of the sea, concerned with itself, sweating in the sun that melted the wing's wax. Unsignificantly off the coast, there was a splash quite unnoticed. This was Icarus drowning."
So 1960, this is late in Williams' career.
This is 3 years before he died. And it is just beautiful. It is accomplished. It describes the painting. The first time, this is the reverse. I knew the poem long before I knew the painting. And the painting pretty much looked exactly the way I imagined.
Right. Now, he's discussing a painting that in his day was attributed to Peter Bruegel the Elder, but is today is most people think is probably a copy of a painting by Peter Bruegel the Elder. Peter Bruegel, if you don't know, you probably know who Hieronymus Bosch is. If you imagine Hieronymus Bosch, but less spooky demons and more peasants with bagpipes, that's Peter Bruegel.
I thought he was like an L.A. cop. Oh, I'm thinking of the wrong Bosch.
This poem does beautifully, accurately describe what the painting does, and that is the painting takes a classical scene and relegates all of the classical elements, all of the dramatic elements to way, way the heck back in the background. And instead, in the foreground, we have what is called in art history a genre scene, a scene of peasants about their peasant work, which is kind of hilarious when you think about it, that this story of Icarus is being shown as barely touching the lives of the people around it.
Right. It's just this, I mean, you have to look carefully to find him in the first place. It's kind of like a Where's Waldo, even. And it's just this little bit of feathers and legs off in the sea way over there. And life goes on. Here's this great epic. Here's this great lesson that we've all heard. And life goes on. Nobody noticed.
This is not even the first poem that was written about this particular painting. Auden wrote a poem about this called Musée des Beaux-Arts back in 1939. And both Auden and Williams comment on how the painter has relegated the action to the background. Auden takes a much more explicitly philosophical approach. I do recommend you go and find that poem. It is almost as short as the poem by Williams, but it does give a moral to this that, interestingly, Williams avoids entirely.
He's not interested in that at all. Yeah, the interesting thing about Beaux-Arts is that he's almost giving too much detail and too much importance. He's describing the fall. He's saying everything turns away from it. I don't think they even noticed. That's not what this is about. That's not what this painting is. And that everything in it has meaning specifically tied to Icarus. And I think, I think Williams has it right. There's just this little noise off in the distance and, oh, what was that? Eh, whatever. And life goes on. And it's a little ornate. It's full of descriptions and things. It's like it is poetic with a capital poet.
It actually has a rhyme scheme,
right? That's just weird, man.
Well, sophomores out there, that's your homework now, is to go and write a comparative essay on Auden's and Williams's different treatments of this painting.
And we are not reading the Auden. So you have to go find it.
I love poems about paintings, partly because, again, in my real life, I work in a museum and I have a master's in art history. I do encourage everyone to look up both the paintings we've talked about, because they will increase your enjoyment of these poems quite a bit.
Oh, absolutely.
Where would we go from here if you were to take someone by the hand and try to convince them that Williams was worth bringing into your life?
I would say look for poems like By the Road to the Contagious Hospital, Asphodel, That Greeny Flower. That one you might read and go, I don't know. But that's another one of his more famous poems that, you know, when you get into that deeper poetry survey in college, you might get that one. You know, look through Pictures from Bruegel and Other Poems, one of his collections. Look through Spring and All. Which is that? I think that's where is that where This Is Just to Say is from? No, that's where Red Wheelbarrow is originally from. So that's from the 20s. Pictures from Bruegel is from the 60s, right at the end of his life. And then take a look at Patterson. Patterson was his grand epic poem, which he wrote in five sections over the course of about 10 years, 12 years, something like that. And it is a grand epic of Patterson, New Jersey, which, exactly, that's funny, right? But it's sort of the culmination of that idea of the colloquial, of the basic, of just this is life here where I am, right? And it elevates the simple and prosaic into poetry. It's quite beautiful.
It was his response to having read Ulysses, or
right.
And he wanted to do for Patterson what Joyce had done for Dublin. Now, of course, the two have nothing to do with each other stylistically.
Thank God. Did I say that out loud? I may have said that out loud.
We live in a time now where people like to proclaim the death of the author, meaning that authorial intent is not the method we should use to interpret, that we should focus upon reader response, or we should focus on theoretical apparatus outside of the work itself. I don't believe author intent is the be-all, end-all, but I do think it's an interesting thing to look at. I think it's fascinating to think about what the author thought he was up to, because right. Especially when it goes completely against what you think the work is doing.
Well, it's like Hemingway famously said, you know, I don't have any symbolism in my work. And you just want to say to him, Ernie, you failed. Wow, did you fail? If that's what you were aiming for, yoop, gone. Yeah, as authorial intent is fine. It's interesting. It doesn't always, it's not the be all and end all.
I would say to anyone out there who only knows Williams from A Bowl of Plums in an Icebox, do look him up. He did write so many, many short poems. And if you're the kind of person who is a poetry skeptic, who doesn't feel as though you have time or interest for poetry in your life, he might be a guy you could nibble away at because he's charming.
Yes.
I mean, that's the other thing about This Is Just to Say, is ultimately it's charming. It's a charming display of a kind of a discourse that happens in a relationship where someone is apologizing without really apologizing. And that's
right.
Delightful.
Right. Just even looking at these four poems, right, there's a clear progression over his life, how he's starting out just describing a thing. And that fire engine, it's a beautiful description of it, but it's just describing a thing in a moment. And then Red Wheelbarrow, and This Is Just to Say, now you have tension. Both of them start with tension, right? Forgive me, I've eaten the plums, right? So already the protagonist of the poem, if we want to say that, is starting off on his back feet, his back foot, right? He's like, I'm sorry, I stole the plums, sorry. And so there's already a little bit more depth to those simple things. And then you have this near the end of his life where it's this this grand tapestry, totally ignoring the little tiny detail that seems to be so important, right? And what is that saying to us? And it's, you know, it's the more you read these and the more you put them together in that context and the more you think about that progression and you go, all right, it's not just a picture of a wheelbarrow, right? And I will say, when I was in 9th and 10th grade, I was not a huge fan of poetry. Big shock. And I had also grown up with P.D.Q. Bach. And, you know, if anyone knows the radio theater, they know I'm a very silly person. So I started doing the poetic equivalent of P.D.Q. Bach, Carlos William Carlos, which was, it literally was to make fun of poetry. And the more I did the parody, the more I wanted it to sound right, the more I wanted it to not just be a silly thing. I wanted it to have the shape and feel right and feel of a piece. And the more I did that, the more I came to appreciate the craft of the original poetry. And that's how I fell into loving poetry, was making fun of it. Go figure. And every now and then on April 1st, because April is National Poetry Month, I do sometimes go and do a live reading of silly, silly poems. I've already done the one tweet here. I will do this one only because it's fast and I have it memorized, and I know it's not a Williams poem, but this is sort of the same mental thing. It's like trying to sound like the poet. It's called Stopping by Weeds on a Frosty Evening. Whose weeds these are, I think I know. His house is mine own, although I cannot see it stopping here, for year by year these damned weeds grow. My little child must think it queer to look, not see the farmhouse near, between the weeds and icy lake, the coldest workday of the year. He gives his little hands a shake to see if I will let him take a break from our sworn job to keep of clearing out with heavy rake. The weeds are hell both dark and deep, but I have premises to keep, and weeds to hoe before I reap, and weeds to hoe before I reap. Which is ridiculous. But, you know, it's not just, hey, let's make fun of Frost. And I will say it took me a year before I realized, oh, premises. That's the joke. I was doing it the other way. Oh, premises. Yes. Right. So writers still, I have to think Williams, you know, 40 years later went, maybe it was a blue wheelbarrow. Maybe that's better. I don't know.
Thanks to co-host David Lohr. David can be heard on the Incomparable Radio Theater. Readings this time were by Kathy Campbell, Moises Kahulian, Steve Lutz, and Jessica Epstein. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network, which does a lot of great podcasts. You should really check them out. Write me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Join the Facebook group, Slack on the membership Slack. By now, your parents should have received your back-to-school supply list. And as always, everything will be on the final.